ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. It's Monday the 12th of January. I'm Annie Guest, coming to you from the lands of the Turrbal and Yuggera people in Brisbane. This Monday, Victorian farmers count the cost of devastating bushfires. And a long, strange trip comes to an end for Bob Weir, of Grateful Dead fame, who's died at 78.
Bobby covered the bass notes sometimes. Sometimes he played lead. None of them played conventionally. And that required all of them to listen to each other, which is the essence of improvisational music, and that's what made them special.
While there's a temporary easing of conditions in Victoria, 30 blazes continue to burn across the state. At least 300 buildings have been destroyed and more than 400,000 hectares of land burnt. Victoria's Premier has expressed condolences to the family of a man who was found dead yesterday in the central Victorian town of Goba. Longwood, Natimuck and Harcourt are among the hardest hit areas. Reporter Oliver Gordon has been in Harcourt, where about 50 homes have been destroyed. We spoke to him from nearby Castlemaine. Hi, Ollie. What's it like in Harcourt, and is it safe for residents to return yet?
Hi, Annie. So I've been lucky enough to have been escorted by the CFA through Harcourt over the last few days when I've been here, and it's really pretty harrowing scenes. As soon as you get into Harcourt, both sides of the road are blackened bushland, and it's not far away from really disturbing scenes of multiple houses that have been turned into nothing more than just chimney stacks remaining. You know, you can see lots of corrugated iron that's was previously roofs collapsed in on burnt out cars, and really troubling details of the way that people have decorated their houses and gardens, blackened and burned. So really troubling scenes in Harcourt. And to answer your question about whether it's safe for residents to return, simply put, the answer is no. There's still too many trees that are damaged. We went past a number of trees that were really just hanging on by a thread, and the forestry team, dozens of forestry workers actually, had been going through and sort of marking the trees that they deemed still dangerous with a spray can, and then knocking them down in a controlled way. It's my understanding that that work isn't yet complete. So at the moment, residents are unable to return, Annie.
So Ollie, residents have been waiting days to learn more about their homes. How are they accessing information?
So there is a recovery hub that has been set up here in the town of Castlemaine, which is just about 10 k's away from Harcourt. Fire-affected residents can come here to Castlemaine to connect with services and also work out how they can get some of these payments that have been announced in recent days by the federal and state governments. We have started to hear some stories of people who have lost property in the Harcourt fires. So although the roads are blocked, some residents have been able to access their properties. Max Lesser is one of them.
Behind me is my house, which I used for social housing for people, and we made it a bit of an artistic icon in the community to show what can be done to help people out. And I'm really sad for the people that were occupying it.
Max, you're a photographer. You're taking pictures of something now that was so different so recently. What emotions does it bring up?
Look, it's just one of sadness, exasperation and disbelief. You know, the small community, and this seems to have been sort of a little bit of the epicentre, but they've saved some of the other structures, so I'm not alone. You know, this whole, my neighbours have all gone as well. They put a lot of work into that house, beautifully done. Landscaping, interiors, and it's just nothing. And I just don't know how you recover from stuff like this.
That's regional Victorian resident Max Lesser there. And before that, our reporter, Oliver Gordon. Victorian farmers are reporting damage to agricultural land in the tens of millions of dollars. They're also dealing with the death of livestock. Volunteers are rallying to help, delivering ammunition and hay to those in need. Kathleen O'Connor reports.
As bushfires ease in some areas of the state, devastated farmers like Matt Fowles are counting their losses.
We had 118 surviving sheep out of a mob of 1,260.
Bushfire ripped through his property near Avenel in central Victoria.
It just annihilated everything. My home, sheds, we've got 14, I think nearly, it'd be, God, 1,100 sheep. Vineyard.
He's just one of many producers who suffered significant losses. President of the Victorian Farmers Federation, Brett Hosking, has been in the affected areas.
We're talking tens of millions of dollars livestock loss alone. You know, that's not factoring fodder loss, and it's not factoring crop loss.
Brett Hosking says the full extent of the damage remains unclear, with bushfires still burning in some places.
We've seen vineyards destroyed. The cost of this will be staggering, absolutely staggering.
So far, the state's control centre says agriculture losses include livestock, cropping land and vineyards in central and northeast Victoria. Some farmers have told the ABC they're frustrated the assistance isn't coming fast enough. Brett Hosking says producers are going to need all the help they can get.
If you think about it in terms of agricultural output, Victoria is just 2% of Australia's farmland. We produce a quarter of Australia's food and fibre. So the losses we're seeing in Victoria impact Australia in a really significant way. So this is a national crisis, and we do need national support.
State and federal governments have pledged more than $19 million in immediate support packages for affected residents. The money will help get fodder to farmers suffering significant livestock losses, pay for emergency accommodation and provide mental health support. Jacinta Allen is the Victorian Premier.
Not only do we know that there has been huge impacts on our agricultural community, many of these fires have gone through prime agricultural land, prime primary producing land. There's been a lot of loss of fences, stock, and the stock that is there needs fodder. And so that relief and support is also being immediately activated.
Truckloads of fodder is already arriving in Longwood in central Victoria. Stephen Threffel from Trellis Fishing and Hunting in Shepparton is donating ammunition to farmers so they can euthanise livestock. He's been inundated with requests.
To be honest, I haven't seen anything like this, but it's just the guys that are coming in. You know, some of these farmers in their 70s and 80s, they've got tears in their eyes and they're showing me photos of livestock and equipment that's been burnt and sheds and things. And now they've got the daunting task of, you know, getting back onto their farms for one with regulations and then going through and sorting out their stock. And then it's not just putting it down. Then you've got to probably dig holes and get rid of things, you know.
Blake Sheather from Wangaratta has also been volunteering to help affected farmers.
It started off with my brother, actually. He's up in the Longwood fires himself on a fairly large farm up there. And he rang me after the fire went through his place and they lost everything but the house. Then he had to get in the paddock and then start shooting his own livestock. We've got about 50 different harvesters that work for us that are spread all over Victoria. And my phone just started ringing from those boys saying, how do we help? How do we help? I've had a massive response from people wanting to help and people needing help.
Wangaratta resident Blake Sheather, ending that report by Kathleen O'Connor. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on the Listen app. Subscribe to the podcast for all our stories. Just search for The World Today. Amid the extraordinary protests in Iran, there are reports at least 500 people have been killed and 10,000 detained. The unrest started in response to soaring inflation and the slide of the country's currency. But there are now calls for an end to the Iranian dictatorship. The US has threatened to attack over the killing of protesters, while the Iranian government has vowed it would retaliate. Alison Schau reports.
In Iran's capital, Tehran, bodies wrapped in black bags line the street outside a morgue. For weeks, anti-government protests have been held nationwide, sparked by soaring inflation and concerns about the economy. So far, 490 protesters and 48 security personnel have been killed, according to the Human Rights Activists News Agency. More than 10,000 people have been detained. Iran's President Masoud Pezeshkian blames Iran's enemies.
The United States and Israel are sitting there, giving instructions to these people, telling them, go ahead, we're backing you.
US President Donald Trump has warned Iranian leaders against using force against demonstrators, writing on Truth Social that the US stands ready to help. But hardline leaders in Iran, like Speaker of the Parliament Mohammad Bagheer Khalibaf, are vowing retaliation if the US intervenes.
Be aware that if you take action to attack Iran, both the occupied territories and all US military centres, bases and ships in the region will be considered legitimate targets by us.
In Iran's parliament, he praised the Revolutionary Guard and the civilian militia group Basij, saying they stood firm during the protests. He also called the US president delusional. It's unclear how President Trump will respond. The Wall Street Journal is reporting Donald Trump will meet with senior officials on Tuesday to discuss possible missile strikes and cyber attacks. Greg Karlstrom is a Middle East correspondent for The Economist.
I think the question is, what exactly is he planning? It was one thing over the summer to carry out this discreet one-off strike against a very particular target. It's another thing to promise to rescue protesters from the regime. What that means in practice, I think, is a lot murkier.
In Australia, many members of the Iranian diaspora are worried as they watch the protests unfold.
We're emotionally closer to Iran than ever, yet we feel completely powerless.
Nader Zoljalali is co-founder of the Australian-Iranian Community Alliance. He says the communications blackout in Iran has largely cut the country off from the outside world.
It's a tactic that the regime, the Islamic Republic, they're using to hide from the eyes of the world the murders and the crimes they're committing inside Iran, and secondly as a tactic to quell the uprising.
As the violent crackdown continues, activists overseas say the resolve of the Iranian people remains strong. Across Europe, rallies are being held in solidarity.
Freedom for Iran!
We hope that the fall of the current regime will happen in the next few days.
We need a strong position in Europe. It's just like calling it, it's a shame, it's not enough, because people are dying.
Negin Sherikai is founder of the Azadi Network, which supports minority groups inside Iran.
From what I hear on the ground, they say we don't have anything else to lose. And this is our push, and we're going to go until they fall down.
Negin Sherikai, founder of the Azadi Network, ending that report by Alison Shao. Kylie Moore Gilbert was imprisoned by Iran for more than 2 years on false charges of espionage. She's a Middle East scholar at Macquarie University, and I spoke to her earlier. Kylie Moore Gilbert, you've had unique insights into how the Iranian regime operates. Can you explain how it's using both the military, including a brutal civilian force, and the internet as weaponry?
So in the past 3 days or so, we've seen the internet entirely shut down by the Iranian regime, an almost unprecedented blackout, actually. They've shut it down before, but never to this extent. They're even using military jamming devices to prevent Starlink from receiving pictures and videos of the horrific massacre that we've heard about in the last few days from reaching the outside world, which is something they haven't done before as well. So there's literally an information blackout, very, very few bits of information are filtering through, and that we have seen is quite shocking and horrific. And, you know, in terms of the security forces they're using against protesters, we've largely seen IRGC, so the Revolutionary Guard Corps, and its affiliated civilian militia, the Basij, be the ones on the street who are actively using live fire against protesters and are brutally suppressing these peaceful protests. The Iranian official military per se has not stepped in any meaningful way as of yet.
The Iranian dictatorship, known as the Islamic Republic regime, and its supreme leader have survived significant protests before. What signs are you looking for that things could be different this time?
What needs to happen for this peaceful movement to succeed is a splintering of the regime. We need to see, for example, some of the security forces refusing to fire on protesters or even defecting to the side of the protesters. Or we need to see some kind of split politically, say, within the regime. There have been some isolated figures, clerics, for example, who would be traditionally aligned with the Islamic Republic regime, who have come out and said, this, what's happening is bad, we don't support it, we don't support killing innocent people. But by and large, as of yet, we haven't seen a significant split in the regime or amongst that elite class of pro-regime supporters. And absent that, you know, these guys have all the guns, they have all the weapons, they have the monopoly on violence, and, you know, the protesters are just sitting ducks for that violence until such an event might occur where we would see a division or a split emerge.
The US President Donald Trump's been making threats against Iran. How important are those threats to the protesters, and how real do you think the prospect is of US action?
I think they've heartened the protesters. We've seen some protest chants referencing Trump, for example. I don't think they've had a huge impact except for triggering the Islamic Republic political forces to mobilize against Trump and to start making threats, for example, to attack US military bases in other parts of the Middle East or US shipping in the Persian Gulf. But we haven't actually seen much impact as of yet. Whether or not Trump actually decides to get involved, you know, will determine everything. And if he does get involved, who does he target? Which sites does he target and in what manner? It is a double-edged sword. It could easily backfire. It could, you know, mobilize that small but quite ideological cohort of people who do still support the regime further. Or it could lead to unintended consequences. For example, if Ayatollah Khamenei is removed, similar to what they did to Maduro, who steps into the breach, and is it somebody even worse or a group of people even worse? So I think it's quite risky should any external power get involved in such a direct way, for example, using military force. It would be much more prudent for them to support the Iranian protest, for example, by restoring internet access or interfering with the regime's ability to shut down the internet.
The son of Iran's deposed Shah has emerged as a symbolic figure here. Some protesters are chanting in support of him as a potential leader, and he says he's prepared to return to Iran at the first opportunity. Do people genuinely see him as a potential leader, and is he a democratic alternative?
There is a influential cohort of Iranians in the diaspora and some within Iran as well who support Reza Pahlavi, the son of the deposed Shah, as a potential future leader of Iran. But I do think that Reza Pahlavi is ultimately a divisive figure. He is one of many and several influential opposition figures in the diaspora, although I do think it's a bit premature given the regime is still in power.
Kylie Moore-Gilbert, thank you very much for joining the world today.
Thanks for having me on.
It's an ancient building material transformed by modern technology. Researchers in Melbourne are developing a 3D printer that can build houses using just earth and plant fibres. They say the aim is to construct low-cost, environmentally friendly housing using just the dirt beneath our feet, as Bridget Fitzgerald reports.
Moving back and forth across a small platform, the mechanical arm of this 3D printer is creating a wave pattern. Layer by layer, the machine is forming an L-shaped block. It looks like concrete, but it's not. It's earth, a mix of clay, silt, organic fibres. Really, you could just describe it as plain old dirt.
We need to bring it back, revive it, and see how we can use it for the future.
Dr. Mohamed Gomar, a senior lecturer in architectural engineering at Swinburne University, is leading a project to develop a 3D printing system that uses natural mixtures of earth and plant fibres that could be used to construct housing. Houses have been constructed using 3D printed concrete, which is a synthetic material, both in Australia and around the world. Dr. Gomar says the aim of his project is to find a way to construct housing using natural materials, which are cheaper, more sustainable, and more environmentally friendly.
Naturally, earth is much cheaper, is more abundant, and also it's like the amount of energy used for production. So if you wish to use timber, concrete, there's a huge amount of energy that's being consumed just to produce it.
Dr. Gomar says earth could either be sourced on site or repurposed from soil waste, which has already been excavated from large-scale road or construction projects. The challenge Dr. Gomar now needs to overcome is to work out how to adapt a 3D printer so that it accounts for variations in the soil so it's strong enough to use for housing.
We're trying to create like a framework, like a code that's saying if you're in this location and you find this amount of clay, then you do this.
While the technology may be new, humans have been building and living in earth or mud houses for thousands of years. Peter Hickson, the president of the Earth Building Association of Australia, says earth can be used for walls, floors or outer parts of the house, and it can add to the building's ability to absorb and release heat.
Long term, we need to be looking at buildings that are energy efficient right now, but also over their lifetime.
Peter Hickson's had decades of experience in earth building, and while he supports the Swinburne project, he says the variability in soils will need to be overcome.
There's challenges and unknowns, and I can see the benefit of prefabrication. The beauty of a robotic printer is that it goes day and night and doesn't stop.
Mohamed Gomar says he hopes to get to the point where the technology could be used to build housing in remote communities, helping to save on the cost of both labour and materials.
It's more expensive to transport construction material from urban locations to remote and regional locations. Building with conventional material now, it requires well-trained tradies or builders. The whole process becomes more expensive. So if you're trying to produce affordable housing, then we need to rethink the process, maybe using material that's on site, maybe trying to find a new training program that we can train regional communities into building their own houses, but with new technologies.
Dr. Mohamed Gomar from Swinburne University. Bridget Fitzgerald reporting. Renowned rock guitarist, singer and founding member of the Grateful Dead, Bob Weir, has died. The 1960s outfit behind songs including Truckin' and Sugar Magnolia were known for their psychedelic sound and cult following, with loyal fans called Deadheads following them from city to city. Rachel Hayter reports.
Born in San Francisco in 1947, Bob Weir started playing guitar as a young teenager. Truckin', got my chips cashed in, keep truckin'. At the age of 17 and the height of the city's countercultural movement in the 1960s, he co-founded the band that would become the musical phenomenon, The Grateful Dead.
Bob Weir was a founder member. He met a 21-year-old Jerry Garcia, and they formed a band called The Warlocks and started playing around San Francisco.
Stuart Coop is a music commentator, author and broadcaster, and a self-declared deadhead.
To be a deadhead, I mean, one would slightly flippantly say it's a lifelong commitment. Deadheads are people who have just immersed in the very diverse music that the Grateful Dead made.
What defined Bob Weir's band was the depth of loyalty of the fans. The late lead guitarist and singer Jerry Garcia described the Grateful Dead's audience as like people who like licorice. Not everybody likes licorice, but the people who like licorice really like licorice.
People would organise their holidays to follow the Grateful Dead round America, seeing concert after concert. It was very much a relationship that the Grateful Dead nurtured constantly between the fan base and the band. Sometimes the light's
all shining on me. Bob Weir's former publicist, Dennis McNally, says Bobby was utterly committed to that relationship.
At a Grateful Dead show, everyone in the room was a member of the Grateful Dead. And that was the way the band thought about it. So that they weren't performing in a theatrical sense. They were having a conversation with each other, musically, that included the audience. Bobby subscribed to that and played to that.
And he played with inventive rhythm. Rolling Stone describes the guitarist as an understated master.
Bobby covered the bass notes sometimes. Sometimes he played lead. That required all of them to listen to each other, and that's what made them special.
Speaking on a red carpet a few years ago, Bob Weir said he carries the spirit of his late bandmates with him.
You know, I hear Jerry's guitar crackling all the time when I'm playing. I feel Pigpen, I feel Phil. I carry all that stuff with me when I hit the stage.
In a note, Bob Weir's family say he transitioned peacefully, surrounded by loved ones after succumbing to underlying lung issues. It reads, "May we honour him not only in sorrow, but in how bravely we continue with open hearts, steady steps, and the music leading us home. Hang it up and see what tomorrow brings."
That's Rachel Hayter reporting. And that's all from the World Today team. Thanks for your company. I'm Annie Guest.